I'm Evan Kleiman, daughter of Edith June, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today is special Mother's Day edition of the show. I'm revisiting some past interviews that will make any mother proud. How to feed a teenage boy today on the show. Honor your mother by maybe not turning out so much like her. In search of lost family recipes, and I'll introduce you to the mother of California cuisine. But first, let's stop by the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's in season this second Saturday in May.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Spring is a time of year when we get so many wonderful new things, and we're waiting for the summer fruit. The first summer fruit we get is the cherries, and this is one of the shortest season, highest value, most prized crops in California and the world. Mark Peel is here, as he always is, from Campanile Restaurant and Tar Pit. And Mark, you are beside yourself because we have cherries now.
Oh, I love the cherries. It seems like they come, and then by the time you get your creative juices going, they're gone. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to get a ton of cherries. I'm buying bunches and bunches of cherries and then preserve them. And we're going to do them, we're going to brandy them. Basically, you have to clean them, wash them very well, because you don't want any debris, a little bit of field debris. And then what we're going to do is we're going to sauté them very quickly, add sugar, add brandy, simmer it very, very gently, and then drop the temperature very quickly and seal it up. Put it in the walk-in, and we'll have it for months. And I love it. And you take it out. What my favorite thing? It's great in cocktails, of course, but one of my favorite things, you take it out, and you take the cherries out, and you warm them up again with the brandy and the sugar, and then melt in a little bit of butter, swirl it onto it to emulsify, and spoon it over vanilla ice cream.
Oh. Now, do you pit them?
No. Okay. So they stay intact.
Oh, okay.
They, if you pit them ahead of time, they'll turn mushy. I'm glad you asked me that.
Okay.
Afterwards, when you're taking them out of the brandy and you're going to put them over the ice cream, you can pit them then.
Okay, and how do you pit them if they're already cooked? And you can't use that pitter thing, can you?
Yeah, you can.
Okay.
You don't want to cook them until they're really, really soft. You want to get nice, firm cherries, sauté them. You just want to stop the enzymatic action, because there's a natural enzymatic action that goes on all fruits and vegetables. Raw fruits and vegetables will cause them to decay. As soon as you bring the temperature up to like 180 degrees, those enzymes are denatured, and they'll stay.
Do you need to use a thermometer, some kind of a pastry thermometer, or you just kind of tell, just under a boil or a slow simmer?
I think if you were going to do like 500 pounds and sell them in a store, yeah, you'd need to do that. But if you're going to do it at home, you just need to bring it up to a low simmer.
Okay. All right. And then when you say you cool them really rapidly and put them in the freezer.
No, not in the freezer.
Oh, okay.
Refrigerator.
Refrigerator.
The freezer will kill the texture.
Oh, okay.
You want to cool them rapidly so that they won't lose texture.
Okay.
You know, bring the temperature up. 180 degrees, drop it down as fast as possible. Seal it up.
And now the varieties that are coming, of course, the Bings are going to come a little later. We get a few earlier varieties, but you want a cherry that's crispy, that's crunchy, not mushy. Some of the early varieties, the Burlet, for example, is a mushy cherry, and it's only really used as a pollinator. So you want to make sure your cherries are a little bit crunchy before you start this whole process.
Right. You know, I love the Queen Anne's. The one that's a little mottled yellow
ones,
and red. Those are beautiful and absolutely delicious. And the Rainiers, great. But, you know, you can't beat a Bing for the flavor.
Right, so good. All right, well, they're coming. They're here, and we are excited, and we're going to go make some ice cream, too. All right, Mark, thanks.
Life is a bowl of cherries, right?
Life is good. All right, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Mark Peel from Campanile and Tar Pit. And as we all are, he is excited about cherries, and what a great way to eat them. California has a lot of different growing regions, one of which is the desert. It's the southeastern corner of the state, and that is where we get our early corn and melons. To my farm, we're talking with Gloria Tamay today. To my farm has some property out in Imperial Valley, and it's where you can grow early sweet white corn. It's only the beginning of May, day before Mother's Day, and we already have corn at the farmer's market. And Gloria and her husband, Steve, grow this out there. What kind of corn is it? And when did you decide to add this to your program?
Okay, we've been doing this for the last, about close to 10 years, no? Around there. The reason my husband trying to find an early start to her in the farmer's market, because Ventura County is cold, so he decided, started looking around when it was warmer weather, to trying to get all this stuff in the market because we wouldn't have the corn to probably July if we wouldn't go over there.
Right. In California, the summer corn comes out in July, and the corn you grow and you still grow is your calico, which is a kind of a yellow and white.
And white, yeah.
Yellow and white together.
Okay, we don't have that one over there. We do that one in Ventura.
Now, the white corn is going to be in May, and then your Ventura, your Oxnard corn, comes
in July.
In July.
Uh-huh.
So do they overlap? Will the white corn run out? Will you have both for a while?
We're trying to make combine because of the weather, it's hard to. Sometimes we combine it, sometimes we don't. We probably be short, like, you know, apart like 2 weeks, 1 or 2 weeks apart from the from the Imperial.
And that white corn is so delicious and so sweet. You can even eat it raw.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Long as you get it fresh, you know where, how it is.
And you can cook it on the grill. You can cook it in boiling water. You can scrape it off and make cream corn. You can just, it's so
eat
good.
Eat it in salad. Yeah. You know, just like that.
Just raw in a salad, yeah. So you are, you know, you're at many markets, so we'll find this. It's all the markets you go to. It's a long way to drive. And then not only that, but the whole scene where you're peeling the corn here at the table, you have this mountain of corn husks behind you, and people are buying this corn, and it is so good.
Yes. So you guys need to come and try it.
We definitely will. All right, well, this is great. Corn is in. Summer's coming. Thank you so much, Gloria. We love all the stuff you grow.
Oh, thanks.
As Gloria Tamayo, she's been on the road going back and forth to Imperial to pick up this corn and bring it to the market, and it's fresh and enjoy. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Pictures and recipes from the Market Report are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Depending on where you shop, you might find cactus paddles or nopales. But just what should you do with this prickly produce? Well, let's ask a Mexican. Gustavo Arellano is our man in the OC. He's also food editor at the OC Weekly, and he writes the popular Ask a Mexican column. We caught up with him in his hometown of Anaheim, where he gave us a lesson in cactus with the help of his mom and dad.
In my regular gig as an Ask a Mexican columnist where I answer people's questions about Mexicans, I get all types of questions. People want to know, why do Mexicans eat cactus? I've been eating cactus my entire life. To me, they're as essential to my diet as maybe Chex or Cheerios is for other Americans. It's just something that I never even thought about until people pointed out that, hey, eating cactus is weird. I don't see anything weird about it. So I want to demystify the cactus. I want to demystify the nopales. I want to show Good Food listeners that the cactus is something that you could incorporate into your daily routine. You could grow your own cactus. It literally, it's the easiest thing to do. And what better way to start demystifying than at the home of my parents, Lorenzo y Maria Arellano. We're at the cactus garden, or we call them nopales, the prickly pear cactus. My dad's going to explain how to grow the cactus from, you know, from the small little leaf up to prickly pear fruit. Also, we're going to see him cut the cactus, and then later on, we're going to take those cactuses to my mom, because, you know, Mexican moms, they're the ones who cook. The dads are outside doing all the work. Then she's going to teach us how to cook cactus and make a little salad and a little side dish of cactus, too. Prickly pear cactuses, we describe them as hojas, and I think that's how you say it in English too, leaves. So you'll have something that looks like a paddle. It's a paddle, and they just start growing one paddle on top of another paddle on top of another paddle. So you imagine these cactuses growing paddle by paddle, top by top. You'd let a couple of them grow. The older ones, they'll have this dull green, and the newer ones, the ones that we're going to eat, they're going to be bright green and with much sharper needles than the other cactuses. And the other cactuses, the older leaves, you really can't see the needles as much. And then every once in a while, you'll see the little pear. In Spanish, we call them tuna, not to be confused with the tuna fish, which we call atún. My dad's going to explain to us how to grow the cactus, and then after that, he's going to cut some of the cactus leaves. So I'm going to speak in Spanish, and then I'll translate. So, papi, entonces, díganos, ¿cómo comienza?
Primero escarba uno, hace un hoyo.
You want to make a hole that's about a foot deep. And you leave the hole empty like that for a week so the soil dries out, because if you put it in too early, you put the leaf in too early, then it's just going to rot. And then, so basically, literally, that's how easy it is. No special potting, no special soil. You Just put a hole in the ground. You leave it for a week. Then you plant the water. It's cactus is like the Mexican. We're very, very hardy. We don't need much, and we'll thrive. And so after that, it just starts growing. So we're back here at my parents' house, and I'm here with my mom, and she's going to explain to us how to prepare the cactus, from taking off the needles to the dishes that you could make to some of the recipes that she uses, the whole process. Entonces, mami, ¿cómo usted pela los nopales? How do you take off the needles of the cactus, or how do you peel them? It's literally as simple as you just keep scraping it off until there's no more needles. They're very, very fine needles. They almost look like gray hairs, in fact. The small little gray hairs like men usually grow, like with the sideburns or on the side. I mean, it's literally that fine. It's not big, thick thorns like you would see on a rose. They're very, very fine. And that's a trick with them. I mean, they still pack a punch, so you don't want to prick yourself with them. They'll hurt you. ¿Cómo usted usa guantes para que no se espine usted?
No, I don't mind.
My mom's very tough. She doesn't use gloves when she's doing that. Don't try that at home, please. You just literally just wash them with water, then one more time just check to see if all the needles are gone. After you prepare them, then you just cut them up. You could cut them in strips and rajas, or if you want, you could dice some. And my personal favorite is, do you cook the entire cactus paddle? Once you prepare it, you could put it on the grill, you could fry it, and then from there, it's almost like a steak. It's like the best vegetarian steak of your life. And my favorite way of eating nopales with chorizo. All you do, you get some chorizo balls, you dice them, you get some cactus, you mix it up. It's so simple, but it honestly, as a burrito, my God, you crisp up the flour tortilla. It's the best burrito. Screw the raja, screw the brains. Nopales con chorizo burritos. For Good Food, I'm Gustavo Arellano.
Gustavo Arellano cruises Orange County for a living as the food editor and author of the Ask a Mexican column for the OC Weekly. He's got a book out of the same name. See a picture of his ride and a step-by-step video of growing and cooking nopales at kcrw.com/goodfood. A good mother feeds, clothes, and nurtures her children. When you're the mother of two teenage boys, feeding takes on a whole new meaning. Next, I'll talk with a mom who struggled to keep up with the pace of consumption of her two teenage sons and who finally learned how to feed those rapidly growing organisms called teenage boys. That's coming up on Good Food. Teenage boys are eating machines. Talk to any mom with a couple of these creatures in the house, and the image of locusts about to descend fills the imagination. It's a challenge just to fill them up, let alone make sure those calories going in are healthy calories. Georgia Orcutt speaks from experience in her book, How to Feed a Teenage Boy. And this morning, Georgia is accompanied by her teenage son, Amos. I asked her what a typical day is like in her house.
It was just madness, Evan. One of my boys used to come home at about 4 o'clock and fall down on the floor and tell me he was starving, to which I would scramble around and try to find something to feed him. And then my second son would come in and do the same thing. A few hours later, my husband would come in hungry, and somewhere in there I got to eat, and so did the cat.
Did you find that things were disappearing from the refrigerator that you had earmarked for making a meal?
Absolutely. I would turn around to get a banana and they would all be gone, or there would never be any milk. I would run through the house saying, "Who ate all the cheese?" The quickest things to disappear always did. On a good day, I would have a lot of chicken wings. And the kids would come home and say, "Oh, we had chicken for lunch today." And I would end up at midnight eating chicken wings, thinking there has to be a better way to do this.
So,
Amos, let me ask you, were you aware of the fact that you're sort of torturing your mother and your need to eat food?
I guess I just kind of expected food to be prepared for me, which now if I look back on it, it's very selfish, but that's just the way I thought.
So does that mean that you actually have a role now in preparing your own food?
Yes, I think I do, a lot more than I did at least.
So, Georgia, was this one of your strategies?
Absolutely, Evan. One of the things I discovered is that boys don't know how to do anything, and they don't learn it through osmosis. They don't learn by watching because they are food blind. And so you have to show them how to do everything. The first thing I taught Amos to do, and also my older son Eli, was to simply cut up an orange. And while this sounds unbelievably simplistic, it was very important because we would realize that a bowl of oranges would sit on the table and never get eaten. They represent too much work. Teenage boys have the attention span of mosquitoes, and they're never going to peel an orange. But if you cut it up and put them out on a plate, they'll disappear.
What did you mean by food blind, that boys are food blind?
They can't see anything. The cover of my book is a boy looking into a refrigerator. And if you live with a teenage boy, you'll see that he circles through the house, opens the door to the refrigerator, looks in, closes the door, walks away, and 5 minutes later comes back and does the same thing. And I don't know what he is expecting to find in there. I still never really figured that out. But what I did start to do was take all the makings for sandwiches and put them in a box, a plastic box that just said food on it. And they would pull this out, put it on the counter, and find in there all the things that would make a sandwich. And that seemed to work.
Amos, how do you feel being talked about as if you're sort of remedial?
Well, it sounds kind of truthful, really.
Georgia, give us an idea of growth spurts. How much can boys actually grow during a certain period of time?
Well, it's pretty awesome, Evan. From 13 to 19, boys can easily put on 50% of their ideal body weight, growing up to 10 inches in those years. Very tall boys can suddenly put on 4 inches a year, which is a huge amount of height. And if they're active boys, if they are playing basketball, say, and they have practices of a couple of hours a day, they could need 4,000 calories a day to keep from losing weight during that season. And when you compare this to a parent, maybe a mother who's trying to lose a little weight and stay under 1,500 calories, the teenage boy is needing more than twice what the parent is wanting to eat in a day.
With boys, is it common for them to have the food weirdnesses that we see in girls, or are they just complete and total omnivores?
I think one of the differences is boys suffer all sorts of anxieties. I think in front of the mirror, they can worry about their ears and their noses and their hair. And, you know, many of the issues of self-esteem hit boys. But with the testosterone racing through them, I think they're rarely going to pick at their food.
What are some strategies you can share with other mothers who are in the same boat of having these locusts in the house?
The first thing you need to do is have a constant stream of food available through the house. Don't put all your attention on dinner. Look for things that are very easy to heat up. Start with the frozen food section, and don't turn your nose up at frozen food. Remember that boys like to gnaw on things. They love to nibble on ribs and legs and wings. They like things that are crunchy and that make noise. Give them celery, cucumbers, carrots, apples, crackers, and put together a variety of foods. Don't just give them a burger. Put some carrots on the plate. Give them some apples.
Amos, is cereal your fallback position as it is for so many males?
I think it definitely is. If all else fails, there's always several kinds of cereal that I can choose from.
Thank you so much, Amos. I really appreciate your point of view. And Georgia, I have to say you're a very brave woman.
Well, Evan, this is important stuff because our boys are developing habits. I think we can all say that when they turn 20, they're not suddenly going to discover spinach and Brussels sprouts. And we've got a wonderful opportunity in front of us to connect with them through food.
Georgia Orcutt's book is How to Feed a Teenage Boy. She joined me with her son, Amos. Wondering what to do for this particular Mother's Day? Well, in honor of that very special woman, we've invited two of our favorite sisters, Marilyn and Sheila Brass, to bring with us a story about their mother, and also maybe to share some of her favorite recipes with us. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning to you.
So tell me a little bit about your mom. Was she a great cook?
Absolutely. Now, that's Sheila talking, and this is Marilyn, but I have to agree completely. She was a fabulous cook. And we must say that she was self-taught after she was married to our father. And all she could make as a sweet young thing before marriage was chocolate cake and brownies.
So I know that when I was growing up, in my case, it was the opposite. My mom was a savory cook and not a sweet cook. So I wanted to have some desserts. So I know that that's when I started realizing that there was such a thing as cookbooks. And I went out and I got my mom a cookbook so that we could actually start to make desserts. Did you have an experience like that where you wanted to give your mother a cookbook so that she would enlarge her repertoire a little?
I would say it's the one and only time we ever did it. And we will tell you the faux pas that we made. We were two young kids. The year was 1950, Winthrop, Massachusetts, and the two of us saved our pennies. You know, in those days, Evan, a penny could buy something. And we tootled over to the spinning wheel, which was a very nice gift shop in Winthrop Center. What we did for Mother's Day in 1950 was to buy a copy of the Betty Crocker Picture Cookbook. And I think that's might be familiar to most people because it's a hardcover, and it has a wonderful illustration on the front in red and cream, like a Pennsylvania Dutch flowering illustration. I'll tell you this, we did wrap it beautifully.
And we presented it to my mother, who was sitting down in a chair, which was fortunate for her. And we waited until she opened it, and then she looked first at Marilyn and then at me, and there were tears in her eyes, and we said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "You don't like the way I cook."
And, you know, we of course, we had to console her. We had to encourage her. "Oh, we love your cooking and baking, but we just thought you'd like a cookbook."
Because she only had two cookbooks.
Sheila will describe to you what the Betty Crocker Picture Cookbook looks like now.
Well, the dust jacket is long gone.
Just have a scrap left.
Right, from the fly leaf. And the spine is hopelessly broken, never to be whole again. But it's just wonderful. It's covered with chocolate on the cover.
So she actually used it.
Right. She used it and she loved it.
And then the whole family used it because we opened it and we found a handwritten recipe for beef stew that my father had, actually, I had dictated it to him. And we found a copy in his handwriting of the beef stew recipe and my mother's chocolate velvet cake recipe.
I've never heard of a chocolate velvet cake.
Well, you have now.
Describe it for us.
It's a three-layer chocolate cake, rich dark chocolate. And it has about an inch of frosting on the top.
And in between the layers, too.
And my mother used to toast walnuts, coarsely chopped walnuts, and pat them onto the frosting, you know, around the sides. And we have a very funny story about that cake. The old black cast iron and green enamel stove in the kitchen in Winthrop had a fault. And the fault was that it always baked things at an angle. It could have been the floor. And my mother would do every time she made the chocolate velvet cake was to build up the frosting on one side of the cake.
So it would be level.
Be level. And, of course, after a while, Sheila and I and our cousins and our friends got smart. And we always tried to get a piece of cake from the side that had been built up. One side would have like 3/4 inch, and the other side would have 1.5 inches of frosting on the top. So, you know, we were smart kids. But I have to tell you, my mother also made the most wonderful strudel. It was made with a wonderful cream cheese pastry, and it had dried apricots. And, you know, she rolled the strudel dough very thin, and then she rolled the filling, you know, in the middle and everything. And, you know, the only way I can describe it, it sort of looked, it looked like Jewish sushi, you know, when you cut the pieces.
Like a salmon roll.
Exactly. Yeah, yes. And then Sheila will tell you, remember the other strudel? This was another form of Jewish sushi. Tell Evan about the apple strudel.
Oh, well, my mother also made apple strudel, which was absolutely wonderful. But this was not as narrow as the apricot strudel. This was wide, and it was so crisp. It was flaky. It would just melt in your mouth. You would, you know, wet your fingers and go around the table to pick up all the little crumbs and things. And then she'd sprinkle a little powdered sugar on top.
It was heaven. It was heaven. It was dessert heaven. And, you know, I am a writer, and I like to fantasize and imagine. And I'm trying to imagine what
heaven would be like.
No, dessert heaven.
Oh.
I think we'd probably have our own little clouds, and they would be sort of composed of powdered sugar and meringue. And people would sort of live on these clouds, and they go to visit each other on each other's clouds. And, you know, maybe they'd have a hide a cloud so people could stay over and have breakfast. But, you know, you'd be able to eat anything you wanted, especially, you know, like an extra piece of chocolate velvet cake. And you could sneak in an extra, you know, piece of Jewish sushi, a.k.a. apricot strudel. And you know what would be great? Not only would it taste good and bring back wonderful memories, but they'd have no calories. You would never have to worry in heaven about putting on weight.
You know what I think is heaven?
What?
Spending some time with the two of you. Thank you so much, Marilyn and Sheila. You have been just a pleasure.
Well, it's our pleasure too.
Right back at you.
A recipe from the Brass Sisters is at kcrw.com/goodfood. Family dishes are so elusive. They usually don't come with a recipe, but they do evoke memories of family and tastes long gone. One woman went searching for her great-grandmother's ravioli recipe and found, oh, so much more. I'll be back with more on Good Food in 1 minute here on KCRW and KCRW.com. Maybe you have an old cookie cutter or a spetzel maker or some other tool that's been handed down for generations in your family. Maybe you never really knew who used it or how it was used and what the recipe was, but it sort of sat there hanging on a wall, nudging you in the back of your mind. In the case of Laura Chanon, it was a ravioli making tool. In the process of discovering how it was used, her voyage of discovery uncovered untold memories, traditions, and a really wonderful recipe. So tell me what the very initial impetus was, the thing that just kept bothering you in your mind that made you decide to go on this voyage of discovery.
Well, after some failed efforts to find a family recipe, I remembered a ravioli tool that hung on the wall that came from my father's side of the family, and they were from the Genoa area. So to find the ravioli recipe, I had to first go through family history, and then it set me off on a sort of larger quest all around this icon of this ravioli, which I discovered in Genoa is this food of happiness and happy times and a very, very strong tradition.
Was there anyone in your family amongst your distant cousins, perhaps, or aunts and uncles on your father's side who had deep memories of that ravioli?
Absolutely. My father is a reserved guy, but when I went to him about this ravioli, he opened up and became very warm and told me he loved Aunt Tessie's ravioli. It turned out that he had cousins who were in their 80s, and I talked to one, Adele, a year or so before she died. She still made the ravioli on Christmas.
And was there an actual sort of document, a piece of folded up, stained paper that had writing on it that was maybe not very exact, that was the famous Aunt Tessie ravioli recipe?
But of course, everyone has one.
I love
if you
that.
Dig far enough, you'll find it. I did find it. I reached out to this Adele, lovely woman in her 80s, and I asked her about it, and I said, could you please write it down and send it to me? And when it came, I knew what it was because of the return address, and I was actually, my heart was beating a little quickly to open it up. Here it is. Here's my family recipe, Adele Jesus ravioli. And I open the envelope, and I take out the card, and I start reading the ingredients. And I see flour, eggs, water, chopped meat. I start to get worried because it's raw chopped meat. Frozen spinach, okay. And then a package of Philadelphia cream cheese. So I thought, this cannot be true. This is my authentic family recipe, the Kraft brand of cream cheese. I reached out to my cousin and I said, you mean ricotta cheese, right? And she said, no, I mean Philadelphia cream cheese. So it was with that I decided to really set off on this journey of authenticity to find out what the recipe truly had been.
So you ended up going to Liguria, and I believe you ended up in Genoa, right?
Right. So my first trip, I was very clueless, but I went and I met this wonderful woman named Maria Luisa, taught me how to make beautiful ravioli with three kinds of meat, braised in wine, a million aromatics, just the most glorious meat filling you could imagine. And she made her ravioli, however, using a pasta machine. And I learned these ravioli, they were beautiful. But then I realized this really was not the authentic family recipe for two reasons. I learned it from someone I didn't really know. And secondly, it was made on a machine. And I knew, based on that little ravioli tool, that our family recipe and my great-grandmother Adele Giza made it with a long stick. I don't know how many of your listeners out there know what that really means, but that is a whole era of pasta making that's nearly in the twilight. It's when you might have a stick about, you know, anywhere from 2 to 3 feet long. It's just a cylinder, and there's a movement of pulling and stretching and slapping the dough against the board in a really huge sheet, if you're very good, to make it really thin. And that's
boy,
the way,
is it different.
You know.
Yeah, the porosity and the
exactly.
toothfulness of it is something fabulous.
Exactly.
So at the end of your journey, when you finally settled on a recipe that you will now pass on to your family, what was it like and how different was it from Aunt Tessie's?
Well, what I decided after a lot of research, you know, I went back and looked at all the old books in Italian back to the 13th century. I started to think that my idea of authenticity was too rigid. In the end, I sort of did wind up with something very much like what Maria Carla taught me in a city. I like to braise the meats with wine and butter and aromatics, and I put them through a grinder, and I use fresh greens. But I loosened up. If I want to use some cream cheese, sometimes I do just out of nostalgia or whatever. I nod to Tessie and Adele Giza. I guess you could say that I took something that was more Italian than Italian-American for my own. But I became less stuck up and snobby about the cream cheese, about the frozen spinach, about the ground meat, a lot of things that I turned my nose up. Because what really, really matters with the history and these recipes is not obsessing over exact ingredients, but sort of the meaning of how they're used, how they bring family together, and that sense of home that we're all looking for. So I started to put my energy a little more into that larger sense of authenticity.
It's really a marvelous book. Thank you very much, Laura.
It was great to be here, Evan. Thanks so much.
The Lost Ravioli Recipes of Hoboken, A Search for Food and Family, is Laura Schinone's great book. Here's a way to honor your mother. Don't turn out so much like her. Our mothers make us who we are, and the former editor-in-chief of the now-defunct Gourmet magazine, Ruth Reichel's mother, left her quite an emotional legacy. Ruth writes about her relationship with her mother in her memoir, For You, Mom, Finally. They retitled the paperback edition. Originally, it was titled Not Becoming My Mother. One of the things that I find fascinating and lovely about this book is the way you not only look at your mother as an individual, but sort of look at that generation of women. And you talk about how you feel it's a generation that had to go through some of the worst, that you would never have wanted to be a part of that generation. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, my mother was born in 1908, which means that when she was 12, the 19th Amendment was passed, and life was supposed to get great for women. And, you know, we think of them as the first generation of emancipated women. But in fact, my experience of my mother and all of her friends was that they were smart, educated, and bored to death, that they had nothing to do. And it was exacerbated by the fact that many of them during World War II went to work and actually got to use their educations and became managers. And all of these women went off and worked and were competent and were proud of themselves. And then the war ended and they were all just, you know, told to go home and tie on their aprons. And they had had this taste of freedom, and then they were stuffed back into their homes, and they hated it. And my mother and her friends just, you know, literally sat around being palpably miserable. And, you know, all of the things that had gone into being a homemaker for most of human history, I mean, when it really was a job and it took, you know, everything in you to do the laundry and cook and, you know, help raise food. All of that went away in the 50s with all these labor-saving devices. So they didn't even have real homemaking to do.
So you ended up becoming this prolifically independent, competent professional whose whole life is centered around food.
Yes, it's very ironic. But, you know, I mean, probably, if you think about the fact that my mother poisoned people with her cooking, it makes a certain amount of sense that in self-defense I would become a cook. But, I mean, for me, the real important thing that I learned in researching my mother's life is that when I wake up in the morning grateful that I'm not her, that's what she wanted me to feel. And she gave me this gift, and the gift was, defy me, don't be me. And although I think my mother was disappointed that food was my passion. I mean, she thought it was really stupid, and she was scathing about, you know, when I wrote a cookbook when I was 21, she was just scathing about it. But that's what she had taught me to do. To do what I wanted to do, not what she wanted me to do.
Before you went on this journey of researching this book, who did you think she was? And how different was that than who you found out she really was?
Well, I thought my mother was, you know, she was big. I mean, she was an imposing personality. She was someone you didn't much forget, but I also thought she was really pathetic and a failure at life and, you know, someone who had never managed to make any of her own dreams come true and very sad. And what I found out as I discovered who she really was that she was much more self-aware than I thought that she was, and that she was someone who was generous enough to keep saying to me, I'm a failure, don't be me, because she really believed that life for women could be better than hers had been. And that although she really did, you know, think that her life had amounted to very little, for all of those reasons, she was determined that mine would be better than hers.
Even though your mom was, as you say, taste blind, and even though food in a positive way was not a way in which the two of you communicated affection when you were a child, is there something that you make or you eat that makes you think about your mother?
My mother's greatest culinary tour de force was corn on the cob.
That's so great.
Well, but what was great about it was she had this farm stand that she went to, and she liked, at a time when everybody was eating what my mother called horse corn, big yellow ears of, you know, kernels, my mother liked tender white baby corn. And she would call this farmer. She would get a pot of water boiling, and she would call the farmer, and she would say, you know, I will be there in 10 minutes. And pick the smallest, whitest ears that you've got. And then she would come home, and we would shuck them really quickly and throw them into the pot of water. And she knew, my mother, who undercooked everything, you can undercook corn on the cob. So she would throw it in just till it was hot enough to melt the butter. And she made the best corn I've ever had in my life. And I never eat an ear of corn without thinking, if only this were as good as Mom's.
I've been talking to Ruth Reichel about her book, For You, Mom, Finally, formerly titled Not Becoming My Mother. I'd love to hear about what your mother likes to cook. Leave a comment at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'll be back with celebrated food personality, chef and author Jacques Pepin. He's got some good ideas for ways to show your love. That's when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. We all have moms, and their influence on us is fundamental, essential. They birth us, feed us, comfort us, care for us. If we're very lucky, they share their kitchen with us and transmit a love of food and its preparation. With me this morning is culinary icon Chef Jacques Pepin. His latest book is Chez Jacques, Traditions and Rituals of a Cook. He goes back to his earliest memories of home and cooking with his mother. It's so wonderful to have you here with us this morning.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you.
So was your mom a stay-at-home mom or a working mom?
Oh, working mom. Certainly. My mother took into the habit of buying a little restaurant which was all run down and building it up and selling it and buying another one. My father was a cabinet maker by trade. So it was really my mother running the business. And even though I left home when I was 13 years old, home at that point was a restaurant. So as far as I can remember, from age 5 or 6, I was in a restaurant helping in one way or the other. So she was a great influence on me.
Did she actually cook in the kitchen, or did she
move? Oh, yes. She didn't have money to hire a chef. She was the chef in the kitchen running. Not only that, maybe the most important part, because it was a very inexpensive bistro type of restaurant. What we did was to go to the market, and before going to school in the morning, my brother and I would walk the market along the Saône River in Lyon, which is about close to a mile long, and she would price and buy on the way back, buying like a case of tomato and a case of zucchini, which were slightly soft, and she knew the guy had to get rid of it and trying to get it for a better price for a restaurant. So the buying was very, very important. And then the cooking also, of course.
Give us an idea of some of her dishes.
Well, the crepe that I'm doing, you know, in my book, you can go on cookforthecure.com, and there is a recipe for those crepes I have in the book. Was probably one of the standard things, as well as apple tart. And I have a gratin dauphinois, which is a scalloped potato with milk and cream and garlic. That's one of our classic too. And I have another dish with chicken and morel. That's one of our dish too. So, you know, usually very simple, straightforward, tasty, comfort type of food, you know.
So share with us the crepe recipe.
The best way is to do it in a food processor. You put a cup of flour and about a couple of eggs with it. You add a good cup of milk to it, a dash of salt, a dash of sugar for color, and you pulse that in your processor, you know, a few seconds, and it's done. You don't even have to let that thing, the batter, rest, like many recipes says. I use a little bit of oil I put in it, you know, a no-flavor oil like canola oil. And then you go directly into a non-stick pan and make crepe. It takes about 30 seconds on each side. Very easy to do and just fresh out of the skillet. You know, you put jam in it. That's how my daughter loved it. That's how I had it when I was a child, you know. My mother always made jam, you know, with apricot or strawberry. And in the crepe, which is still hot, warm, you know, you spread out your jam and you roll it or fold it and eat it just right out of the skillet. That's the best way to enjoy crepe, you know.
That sounds like a wonderful Mother's Day brunch dish.
Yes, it is a great Mother's Day dish to do for your mother or your grandmother or your child or your friend. Anyone, it's good to cook together, you know, and sit down around the table and eat and share a story. I have many stories like that in the book. Actually, I have five or six essays also that I wrote because I feel that around the table conversation is very important, sometimes as much as the food.
Yeah, absolutely. The food becomes a vehicle for the communication.
Exactly. And unless you do that, you never speak to your kids or to anyone. You know, so I've been married 41 years, and I don't remember one time that I didn't sit, you know, at the table with my wife and at night, and we share a bottle of wine and the meal. You know, we've always done that, and we still will do that until we go to the other world.
Once you started having some success in the kitchen when you had finally grown away from your years of apprenticeship, your mother must have just been incredibly proud.
Yes, I think that she was. I mean, she used to love to come to the United States. And one time, she was interviewed by someone who said, well, how do you compare your cooking to the one of your son? And she said, well, in translation, she said, well, I am a seamstress, really, and is involved with haute couture. That's not a reaction. It sounds very good.
That's so wonderful. I have to tell you that this latest book, Chez Jacques, may turn out to be my favorite book of yours.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's very intimate. You've shared a lot of yourself in this book.
It is. It's a visual autobiography.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll see you.
Jacques Pepin's book is Chez Jacques. Getting lost in the cookbook section of a bookstore for me is like going down a rabbit hole. I can browse for hours. Writer Ariel Swartley is the same. Before Alice Waters and Julia Child revolutionized American cooking, there was Helen Evans Brown. She's considered the mother of California cuisine. Ariel Swartley is with me now to explain who exactly Helen Evans Brown was and why she was such a pioneer.
She was a new woman for the new century. She went to college. That wasn't, for a woman born in 1904, the usual route. She worked for a living. The stock market crash helped women to learn to do that. She was ambitious, articulate, and very feminine.
So she met this man named Philip Brown. Who was he?
Philip Brown was kind of a wunderkind. I mean, he'd gone to college at 15, and he was already collecting books and cookbooks and selling them in college. He and Helen met, and it was kind of love at first sight, and they eloped.
They left their marriages?
He wasn't married. She was, and they, I think, you know, the story I got was 2 weeks later, they were on the road to Reno for her to get a divorce. And they just shared this passion for eating and talking and living.
It's a time in which America was coming out of those punitive puritanical years of prohibition.
Right. And I think it's such a great constellation. They moved to California. Prohibition had just ended. There was this wonderful outdoor life after, you know, how cold it is in New England. And they began meeting fascinating people. Their circle were artists and writers.
And so into this sort of new openness came this couple who themselves were chewing up life, so to speak. And they found a man, Robert Balzer, who became a close friend. Tell us a little bit about him.
Robert Balzer's father had come to California. He was a grocer in the Midwest, and he had a daughter who was ill, and he moved to California to start a grocery business. And his first grocery store was in West Adams, the fanciest neighborhood in town. But this was in the 1920s, and the fancy neighborhood center was moving. And as Windsor Square was built in Hancock Park, he bought leased a store on Larchmont and opened a grocery for the people who were ordering, you know, food for very large houses, for people who were throwing wonderful parties and wanted good cheese and wanted assistance, you know, wanted their order packaged and delivered.
And so Helen came to work at Balzer's and started writing recipes for their newsletter.
Initially, she was writing recipes for Robert Balzer's radio show about food at a Beverly Hills station. And when he was called up to go to war, World War II, she managed the store when he left for the war and was writing for this newsletter. Meanwhile, her husband, Philip, was working as a rare book dealer and amassing these amazing California cookbooks, among other things.
And she started writing cookbooks, and her prose, the way she combined the openness, the sensuality of food and living with a recipe. Are you a profound book hound?
Yes.
Now, why is that? Talk to me a little bit about collecting books, cookbooks, and what these older books tell us about the way we live and where we've been.
I think when you open a cookbook, you're getting several layers of information. You get what's printed on the page, the actual recipes, and some of them are pretty strange. I mean, Helen Evans Brown found a recipe for shoulder of elk. But you also get the notations that someone who's owned the book before you has written in, or a scrap of paper that says, a better recipe for pickled figs is, and they put in their own. And a lot of the old cookbooks also give you menus, because they were at the end of the 19th century, as fewer people had servants, and there became a kind of more scientific view of how to cook for domestic science. You know, you're no longer a housewife; you're a domestic scientist. And people wrote these very extensive books about how to construct a balanced diet, how to feed an invalid, but also how to entertain, how to arrange, you know, fruit and flower patterns for a salad for the bridge club. And so there are all kinds of windows on how people were living, and nobody's making a big deal about it, so you really do feel like a peeping Tom. Here's one that is so great. I got this from Helen Evans Brown's cookbook that she describes. She got it from a San Diego community cookbook, probably at the turn of the century. They did fried ice cream in little logs, built the logs like a little log cabin, soaked sugar cubes in brandy, put them inside the log cabin, and served this to each person, guest, with a book of matches. And then you set your sugar cubes on fire, and it goes up in flames.
It's like Baked Alaska to another level.
Yes, yes. And it's, you know, DIY. It's just great.
So funny. One of the things I find in some of these cookbooks that's so interesting is the juxtaposition of this embracing of the natural that one would expect in Southern California combined with mayonnaise and sour cream.
Oh, well, there is a great salad. It came from an Atwater Village cookbook about 1916, I think. And it's called a poinsettia salad. And here's how you do it. You take a pineapple ring, and you spread the pineapple ring with cream cheese. And then you take pimento strips, and you lay them on the cream cheese to look like petals radiating from the center. And then the center you fill with mayonnaise. And this made a lot more sense when I realized they think you're going to make the mayonnaise yourself, so it's going to be really yellow with egg yolk. Put a glob of mayonnaise in the middle, and then you put slices of black olives over the mayonnaise so it looks like that center of the poinsettia.
I think a lot of these recipes were made to go with drinks.
Oh.
With hard liquor.
That's the secret life of sour cream. And that is, of course, one of the things I discovered, that a lot of these recipes, they have two vectors, outdoor cooking and strong drink.
Ariel Swartley's piece on Helen Evans Brown first appeared in Los Angeles Magazine. Last summer, when I was baking a pie a day and blogging about it, I asked Jonathan Gold to weigh in about his favorite pie. He told me an incredible story about his mom and pie. Jonathan, of course, is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly.
This is a strange story I don't think I've ever told before, but my mom was a really good pie cook. Whenever anything was going on, she'd make a pie. She'd make chocolate pie. She'd make banana cream pies, which is probably why it's my favorite. She'd make strawberry pies with, you know, glazed with just a tiny bit of currant jelly. When we realized she only had a few weeks of life left, I went into the kitchen with her and baked pies with her all day. And I think she could barely stand up at that point, but she was just happy to be doing something and happy to be imparting knowledge. And we did, you know, the way she cut it in, the 3-part to 2-part, you know, lard to butter ratio, her particular way of shaking the tablespoon of ice water over the top, and her admonitions, you know, not to touch the dough at all. You know, it was very moving, and I wrote it down. But a lot of it seemed familiar. And then I realized when I was flipping through like a 50s edition of Joy of Cooking that, in fact, that was her recipe, like word for word, including the, you know, things of cutting it until the pieces of dough were the size of lentils or small peas.
She had completely internalized the recipe.
So completely internalized it. She, you know, her mother was Southern, and I thought it was some, you know, great ancient Southern pie recipe handed down through the generations. But in fact, her mother was a dreadful cook, and that must have been where she got her pie recipe.
Beautiful. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
I learned to cook next to my mom. She's 90 now, and I cook for her almost every day. She still teaches me the great lessons of the kitchen. Be generous with flavor as you cook. Don't forget the onion. Share what you have and make sure there's ice cream in the freezer. You can download our podcast and listen to past episodes at kcrw.com/goodfood. Pictures, recipes, videos, and info on all of our guests is at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter there, too. I do cookbook giveaways and share recipes every week. This show is produced by the children of Edie Kleiman, Erica Farrow, Tina Ells, Eivor Carlson, Jennifer Ferguson, and Jackie Foster. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with a fresh edition of Good Food.